Again, it's good to be back here. I feel like I've been all over the place for the past month and a half, I guess. But the thought of my mind this morning is in 1 Peter chapter 1. It's a thought I've stolen from Brother Josh. And give credit where credit's due. He kind of stirred up my thoughts here last time I heard him. And in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, it says, Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to his abundant mercy hath begotten us again unto a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Lively hope is a very interesting, it's an interesting phrase to me. You know, why he could have just said hope, had begotten us again unto a hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. That would have been good enough, I think, because that's a lot to hope in. But he wanted to add a little modifier. He wanted to say lively, because he wanted to describe that hope. And by lively hope, he's talking about that it is active. It is alive. And something being alive, to be alive, and this is Brother Josh's thought that I really liked, if you are alive, you consume something to stay alive, right? We eat food, and by eating food, we turn it into energy, right? Lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Jesus Christ consuming death, but brought us a lively hope. Isn't that an interesting way of thinking about it? That what he did was place a hope within us that was purchased because he consumed death. He consumed death for us. And by doing so, we have something within us that is completely active. It is alive all the time. Alive all the time. But sometimes it's really difficult to remember it. Sometimes you don't want to think about it. Sometimes there's something that happens that takes your mind off of it or keeps you from thinking about it. But it is a hope and it is alive. And I think one of this is the contrast of life and death. And I think one of the best places to go to see where these two things collide with our Lord Jesus Christ is in the story of Lazarus, which is, I think, in John chapter 11. Yeah, it's in John chapter 11. The story of Lazarus, there's a lot to the story of Lazarus. Let's just get it started and see where it goes. Now, there's a certain, this is John chapter 11, verse 1. Now, a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. If you remember that story, there was a woman who washed the feet of Jesus with her tears and dried it with her hair, and that was Mary. Therefore his sister said unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. So here we have the scene set up that Lazarus is sick, and his sisters come running to him saying, Lazarus is sick. They're essentially asking for help. That's what they're asking for. They're asking for Jesus to come and to heal him, as he had done by this point so many times. He'd already done it. You can just read story after story after story of Jesus healing the lame, helping people out with all sorts of afflictions. And so Mary and Martha, who are not just followers of Jesus Christ, but they have a personal human relationship with Jesus. You know, they spent time with Jesus the man. They had conversations with him. They knew him as a person, not just as their Savior, but they knew him as a person. So they go to him and they ask him for his help. And his response, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Okay, so if you want to just assume what's going to happen based on the information that we have, Jesus is about to get up and leave and go to Lazarus and go heal him. That's not what happens. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Verse 6, when he had heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. So, here's the curveball in the story. Jesus hears from these people who he loves very much that someone that he loves, Lazarus, is sick, not just a child of God, but someone who he has a personal relationship with, one-on-one relationship with. He's sick. You think he's about to go, and instead what he does is he stays for 2 days in the same place. This is unique. This is not Jesus' MO up to this point. Jesus, if you want to put a predictability standard on Jesus up to that point, when someone come to him asking for a healing or for, you know, he's going to go. He's going to go do it. That's what he had been doing up to that point. But he didn't. He stayed for 2 days. He stayed for 2 days, and just as a reminder, it says, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. That's his whole purpose for doing what he's doing. He stays for 2 days. In verse 7, it says, then after that saith he to his disciples, let us go into Judea again. His disciples saying to him, Master, the Jews of late sought to stone thee, and goest thou thither again? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of this world. So offering yet another lesson to his disciples. As a reminder, I am the light of this world. If I'm going to go into Judea, it's because it's the will of the Father. Okay. If a man walk in the night, he stumbleth, because there is no light in him. These things said he, and after that he saith unto them, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go, that I may awake him out of sleep. And the disciples said the obvious thing, the thing that I feel like perhaps I would say, Lord, if he sleep, he shall do well. If he's sleeping, he's okay. Howbeit Jesus spake of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest in sleep. And then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. Lazarus is asleep. That was how he chose to describe Lazarus' death. And there's some that have this, it's a misconception about soul sleeping. We're not going to talk about that. But Lazarus was dead. He was completely dead. There's no level 1 dead, level 2 dead. Lazarus was 100% dead. But Jesus said he sleepeth. So I'm going to go ahead and ruin the end of the story for you guys. Lazarus comes back from the dead. God's power, the power of Jesus Christ, that's how much power he has over death. Have you ever woken someone up from a nap? How easy was that for you? That's the parallel that he's drawing. As easy as it is for you to wake someone up from a nap, it is easy for me to wake someone from the dead. That's an analogy. We learn about those in about 3rd or 4th grade. You know, they got the double semicolon or the double colon, you know, those analogies. So he's talking about you are to waking someone from sleep as I am waking someone from the dead. That's the power of God. That's the image he was painting for them to understand. He sleepeth. Well, if he sleeps, he doeth well. No, he's dead. And I am glad, this is 15, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there. And here he goes the second time declaring his intentions. To the intent ye may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. There will be a third time when he declares his intentions. Jesus did not need to do this for any legal reason. This had nothing to, this particular resurrection didn't have anything to do with the work that he was going to do on the cross or the resurrection to come. He did this to display what he could do. He is doing this to display his power over death for everyone to see. He did not, it was not the will of him that the first time this power is witnessed in person for it to be his own resurrection. This is in line with Jesus. This is in line with the Old Testament, isn't it? Because a lot of the Old Testament, they're types and shadows. Moments of showing what was to come. And this moment is used to show that I declare. He already had power over death. This was his moment to declare to us, to declare to his children, to his disciples, to his believers, that he had power over death. To declare it before he used it for his children. Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent ye may believe. Nevertheless, let us go unto him. Then said Thomas, which is called Didymus, unto his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. So they loved him too. You know, this Lazarus was not just known to Jesus. He was known to the disciples. He was known to the circle of people that surrounded Jesus during his ministry. So this is the scene that has been set. So where is this lively hope that we spoke of in 1 Peter? This is where it first comes under the test, so to speak. In 17, it says, then when Jesus came, he found that he had lain in the grave 4 days already. Now, Bethany was nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off. I don't know how long a furlong is. It's a while. And many of the Jews came to Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha and Mary both have similar yet distinct reactions to what's going on here. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary sat still in the house and said, Martha unto Jesus, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. I think that's one of the most relatable moments that you can read in the Bible. At least it is for me. Lord, if you had just been here. Have you ever said that? I've said that, much to my own shame. Lord, if you had just been here, this wouldn't have happened. So-and-so wouldn't have done this thing, this terrible accident, this whatever it is. My brother would not have died if you had just been here. She had a lively hope within her, but she couldn't see it at that moment. She could not see it at that moment. It was not in the forefront of her mind. What she saw was her brother had passed away. And remember, early on, it was a few days ago, she had asked Jesus herself to come. She had asked Jesus, he's sick right now. If you come right now, he'll be okay. If you come at this moment, he'll be all right. He didn't go. He didn't go at that moment. And so Mary, I mean, if you just want to, separate Jesus from the deity that he is, if you just want to think about him as a man, you know, when someone comes up to you and says, you just need it, if you just do this right now, it's going to be okay. Have you ever missed a deadline before? Have you ever missed I missed a deadline this past week on my bus form. And then I got a nasty little email saying, you need to get this 8 days ahead. Okay, I got you. All right, I'm sorry. It was my fault. Jesus missed, from her perspective, a pretty important deadline. How does that shake your trust? Like, what does that do? to shake someone's... This wasn't just some silly bit of paperwork, or you didn't get the lawn mowed on time, or you just, whatever it is. This was her brother, and he died. And she had put her trust in Jesus, and from her perspective, Jesus didn't deliver. From her perspective, Jesus did not deliver. That is relatable to me. When I'm being as short-sighted as I tend to be, and you get to a moment in your life when you really need him, and he's just not there. He's just anywhere else but where you need him to be. What does that do? This is from your perspective. This is not, we understand. We know that God is everywhere. We understand. We know that he is in our lives, that he is not going anywhere. But when the pain is so bad, and the moment is so bad, and it shakes you to your very core, when Martha and Mary themselves went to Jesus in the flesh and said, I just need you here for just a couple of minutes. I just need you in this place at this time for about 90 seconds, and then it will all be okay. And instead, he stays where he was for 2 days, and it wasn't some silly little deadline that was missed. Her brother died. Her brother died. What does that do? What does that do to your trust? What does that do to your perspective? If thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. She has a little bit of a better reaction than her sister down later. In 22 it says, but I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it thee. She is walking on, she's straddling a line. Because she knows her brother is dead. She knows he's actually dead. She knows he's 100% dead. But she refused in that moment to let go of her lively hope, to let go of her thought of it. You can't give it away. Your lively hope's within you. It's there. It's alive. It is working. But she refused to lose sight of it, even in the midst of several things. Jesus didn't come when she thought he would, and her brother died. And Jesus saith unto her, the only thing that could ever make anybody feel better at a funeral, thy brother shall rise again. Thy brother shall rise again. Martha saith unto him, because Martha's good. She knows. She has spent time with Jesus. She knows the truth. And she says, I know that he shall rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus said unto her, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. Believest thou this? Remember the context of what's going on. He's already made two declarations where he's talking about those that see, those that believe will see. That's what he's saying unto her. He's not saying if you believe, you'll have everlasting life. What he's saying is if you believe, you will have your lively hope, a life within you that cannot be extinguished. You will be able to see it. You will be able to hold on to it. And she saith unto him, yea, Lord, I believe that thou art the Christ, the Son of God, which should come into the world. And so in the face of the death of her own brother and the apparent bad timing by Jesus himself, from her own perspective. She still held on to her lively hope. That's difficult. Let's not pretend like it's not. Mary has a little bit more of an emotional reaction. And when she had said so, that's Martha, she went her way and called Mary, her sister, secretly, saying, "The Master is come and calleth for thee." And as soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came unto him. Now Jesus was not yet come into town, but was in that place where Martha met him. The Jews then which were with her in the house and comforted her, when they saw Mary, that she rose up hastily and went out and followed her, saying, "She goeth unto the grave to weep there." Mary's taking this a little bit harder than Martha is. She is. You know, there's no... Grief is not a competition. You know, I think that's important to understand. People are not ranked by how outwardly sad they are. Martha was sad that her brother had died. Mary was sad that her brother had died. They had a different reaction, and there's no need to belittle either one of them for how they reacted. Then when Mary was come where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying unto him, "If thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." End of statement. We have two sisters with two different reactions. Martha, upset, but holding on to her hope. Martha, upset, recognizing her Lord, falling at his knees, but very, very upset. She's upset to the point that she can't process anything. Have you ever been that upset before? Have you ever been so upset you just couldn't think? That's where Mary is right now. She's so upset she can't even think. When Jesus therefore saw her weeping, and the Jews also weeping which came with her, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and said, "Where have ye laid him?" They said unto him, "Lord, come and see." And then the shortest verse in the whole Bible, and also one of the most confusing, in my opinion, Jesus wept. He groaned in the spirit and was troubled. It says he groaned where? In the spirit. God has a very specific reaction to death. He saw someone that he loved had died. And you know, Jesus isn't weeping. Jesus knows how this is going to end up. You know, if he can't possibly be crying because he doesn't know how the situation's going to end up. He knows that Lazarus is coming. He knows he's a child of God. He's going to raise him. This is going to be a joyful occasion bringing him back. What in the world is Jesus crying about? Why is he weeping? He groaned in the spirit and was troubled. We're going to jump really quickly to a very short story in Matthew 26, verse 36. This is, so they've had the Lord's Supper. They've had communion, the foot washing. He's about to be arrested and taken away. And somewhere in the middle, Jesus goes to the Garden in Gethsemane and prays. It says in Matthew 26, verse 36, "Then cometh Jesus with them unto a place called Gethsemane, and said unto the disciples, Sit ye here while I go and pray yonder. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and began to be very sorrowful and heavy." In many ways, sorrowful and heavy, how he was troubled in the spirit in much the same way. And then he saith unto them, My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Doesn't that language sound a little bit familiar? Exceeding sorrowful. Tarry ye here, and watch with me. And he went a little further, and fell on his face, and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. Another confusing part. But it's not, because it's very exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. This is what was approaching him at this moment, was death. The cup that was coming to him was death. He is Jesus Christ. He is the Son of the living God. God is not supposed to taste death. And he's not asking the Father to get out of what he was trying to do or what he was sent to do. He's not asking the Father for a get out of jail free card. That's not what he's asking. He's saying, I am Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, and I'm not supposed to taste death. But it is your will that I do so, so that your children will be saved. That is where he was at that moment. Because remember, he's about to be arrested, taken away, beaten, scourged, crucified. And then he finally dies. 3 days later, comes back, resurrected. Lively hope indeed. What is this? Where is it? It's one short little verse in Corinthians 15. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? Death is swallowed up in victory. That is what Jesus did for us. He swallowed death up into victory. You know, when you eat a piece of bread, you do not become the bread. But the bread becomes a part of you. You ingest it. Its essence becomes part of the energy that sustains your body. And when Jesus took of that cup, he took death into himself so that it might be conquered for us. Which is why we have a lively hope. He took death. And in doing so, he gave us life. He gave us a life that doesn't stop. He gave us a life that in that moment, it does exactly what it did for Martha. What did it do for Martha? Martha saw the death of her brother. She saw the sadness attached to it. She felt it within her very being. And instead of succumbing to that darkness, instead of succumbing to that death and that sin, what she did was she held on to her lively hope. And she remembered what her Lord said. There will be a resurrection. I have conquered death. And I have conquered it for you. Mary needs a little bit of a stronger reminder, doesn't she? It doesn't say particularly why Martha and Mary had such different reactions, but they did. Mary was so sad. She couldn't think straight. She couldn't understand. It just didn't process to her that Jesus was there, that the Son of God was there in the very midst of the worst funeral of her life. In the very midst of this darkest moment, he's standing right there. Don't you understand? It's okay. It hurts. Death itself is wrong. It's not supposed to be all right. You're not supposed to process it well. What you are supposed to do is when you see Jesus in your midst, you cling to him. You cling to that lively hope. You remind yourself of what he's done for you. You remind yourself because He is there. He's right there. So how does this end? John 11:34, and said, "Where have you laid him?" They said unto him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Then said the Jews, "Behold how he loved him." And he did. And some of them said, "Could not this man, which opened the eyes of the blind, have caused that even this man should not have died?" So again, more people questioning. Questions, questions, questions. You know, there are some funerals that are, for lack of a better word, are okay. My grandparents on my mom's side of the family, Mama had lived a full life. It was sad to see her go, but it was okay. The same thing with Papa. It was sad to see him go, especially, you know, with the cancer being as bad as it was. But he had lived a full life. And it was okay. And then there are funerals that are not okay. You know, this where it's just not okay. When I was in high school, someone died in a car wreck. You ever been in a funeral with a bunch of teenagers? That's not okay. That's not an okay moment. I know I did at the time. I just didn't know what to think about it. I just didn't know how to process it. And so there's just question after question after question in this very not okay moment. Could not this man have caused that he should not have died? Jesus, therefore, again, groaning in himself, cometh to the grave. It was a cave and a stone lay upon it. So let's pause real quick because Jesus is doing something very, very purposeful. Remember, his declaration, that he's made two declarations already. He's about to make a third. And the scene is that Jesus is not anywhere near the stone. He's within shouting distance. But he's not next to the stone. He's not next to the grave. He never touches Lazarus. As a matter of fact, all he does is stand far enough away from it and give commands, not just to Lazarus, but to people around him. First one he says is, "Take ye away the stone." Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith unto him, "Lord, by this time he stinketh, for he hath been dead 4 days." Mama! Take away the stone. There's a whoosh of air. It's not pleasant. Mama! This is just more and more of a display. He's doing this to display his power. And so the first thing he has to do is display the death. And there is nothing. The smell just went everywhere, I'm sure. You know, so there was plenty of evidence for everyone around to see that he is dead. Everyone there knew after that stone rolled away that Lazarus was dead. So there it is. Martha, the sister of him that was dead, saith that he'd been dead 4 days. Jesus saith unto her, "Said I not unto thee that if thou wouldest believe, thou shouldest see the glory of God?" There it is. If you believe, you see it. If you believe, you see it. If you don't believe, you don't. It's not that you don't have it. You don't see it. There is a difference. If you don't believe, you don't see the glory of God. He doesn't need us to believe to work within us. But it is tantamount on our part to believe so that we might see it. Not to have it, but to see it. 41. Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, and here's his third declaration, "Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me." The Father always hears Jesus. Jesus doesn't need to say this prayer so that he and the Father can get on the same page. His explanation for it is in the very next sentence. And I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. So that is his third declaration. The scene is set. The grief has been on display. Death is everywhere, not just emotionally, but physically. There is grief in the sisters, and I'm sure in of all of the relatives and friends that are there. The stone rolls away and the physical remnants of death have been spread into the area. This whole place is covered in death. And all Jesus says, when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And that was it. That was it. When he said earlier, the analogy, as easy it is for you to wake someone out of sleep, it is for me. That's exactly what he did. He didn't go near Lazarus. He didn't touch Lazarus. He didn't even get anywhere near the tomb. He spoke with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus came forth in the midst of death, drowning in it. A scene that's just dripping with death. Not just the physical remains of it, but the collateral damage of it with the people that loved Lazarus. Everywhere around him was death. Everywhere carried in the people that loved Lazarus, including Jesus Christ. And he overcame it with one sentence, with three words, with a name and a direction. He specified who he was talking to. He said, come, and then he said, forth. Because not only did Lazarus come to life, but he physically came forward. Which, when we read the next part, is going to be even more incredible. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto him, loose him and let him go. And the grave clothes are a body cast. It's what it is. It's cloth dipped in an ointment and wrapped around the body. And when the ointment dries, it becomes solid. It's a cast. He can't move. But he came forth. He that was dead and unable to move within the grave clothes came forth. And again, he gives one final direction to everyone that's there. Loose him and let him go. This is where it parallels with gospel regeneration, or with regeneration and then the gospel. Because when people first experience that lively hope, unfortunately, they're also carrying with them their whole life that came before that. Your first experience of a lively hope does not explode the grave clothes off of you. They're there. And the purpose of the gospel, and one of the purposes of the church itself, is to recognize that and to help people get those grave clothes off. To help one another. Through the Holy Spirit. Through spiritual effort with one another. To loose him and let him go so that that lively hope within you can shine brighter. So that it can shine in the midst of being surrounded by death. You know what? Lazarus came forth. That scene didn't shift immediately. He was still in a tomb. He was still in a tomb. He was in death clothes. The people around him couldn't believe it. His face was covered with a napkin. Would you even be certain that he was alive? This thing unfolded slowly. But think of the great rejoicing that happened when those grave clothes were... He was alive, but he was ready to live when those grave clothes were removed. That's what happens when these things strike us. When these terrible moments strike us, they come with grave clothes. It comes with death. It comes with the air of death. It comes with the emotions of death. And only through a lively hope, through remembering that lively hope, through exercising that lively hope, through helping others exercise that lively hope, can we overcome these moments of death in our lives. Not just the death of loved ones, but any time these moments happen. Anytime these moments happen that want to distract you from the work that Jesus has done, want to distract you from his love for you, want to distract you from the thought that he was always with you in every moment. That in the worst funeral of your life, he will be standing right there next to you. And your loved one will have already been taken home by him. That is where our lively hope is. And then, of course, on the last day, on the final resurrection, the resurrection where we all go home, there is our lively hope. And if you believe that this morning, you will see it. I thank you for your kind attention.